Well, I feel honored to speak in front of all of you. Just looking at the guest list, it's quite impressive, to say the least. So I am the Chief Operating Officer and also Chief Information Officer, so I wear kind of a dual hat. And it includes a number of different areas within the firm that you can think of pulling together in the context of a value chain. So the idea is to gain synergies across all of our businesses. That's really how we think about things. So we've been on our journey with DLT technology and blockchain specifically, and we think about it in two contexts. What can we do internally and what can we do externally with customers? On the internal side, it's really all been about focusing on reducing error rates and also improving our cost structure. And obviously, when you focus on error rates, you tend to impact the cost structure in a positive way. And really, it's been a learning process as opposed to thinking that this is a guaranteed way of being successful. We're experimenting with a couple of different technologies, and we want to make sure that it really scales the way we believe it scales because of all the constraints that we tend to operate under. We're obviously a critical infrastructure for the country, and we have to do things right, and we're heavily regulated, particularly in the clearing area. And when I say clearing, I mean the clearinghouse, LCH. So we began the process through what I'd call an emerging technologies group, headed by a gentleman who kind of concentrated on the areas of blockchain that were available back in early 2015. I joined the firm towards the end of 2015. And when I joined the firm, we had already decided that we would focus on the Hyperledger fabric. And a part of the reason we did that was it was open source. We figured we could learn faster, and we could get the benefit of partners that were also investing. And one of those partners is actually IBM. And Keith was actually one of the gentlemen that has brought IBM and our company together. And we worked together on a couple of different use cases to evaluate what this technology could do for us and our customers. And we got to be fairly proficient at it and became one of the developers of the Hyperledger fabric and have pretty much stuck with that in terms of our core expertise. And we implemented some use cases internally. And the way I think about it at the moment is it's sort of, for me, it's a no-brainer for eliminating the concept of reconciliation, right? Because you've got an authoritative source of data, and you don't have to reconcile different data stores. So that's how we kind of oversimplify it, if you will. And it's been successful in demonstrating that the technology actually works. It sort of works as advertised. What we don't know is how far it will scale, because we really haven't evaluated that just yet. It's not running in production yet, but it is something that we would plan to put in production. Moving from just pure reconciliation, we actually also implemented it in one of our Italian entities called Monte Titoli. And what we did there was we took what was really paper-based shares and digitized those assets on a blockchain. And that also was very successful, and we also worked with IBM on that. And what was interesting is that project went very fast, because we had a lot more knowledge and a lot more confidence in what we were doing. And I, you know, we had this working relationship with IBM, which has been quite fruitful. And that's something that we feel, you know, very very comfortable with, that it works well, and it's not been a scalability challenge for us at all. While this has been running internally in parallel, we've done some use cases with customers, some of which were business cases that worked out well, and some, frankly, weren't business cases that we really were interested in pursuing to completion. And the way we think about this is emerging technology for me is you're experimenting with something, you never really know what's going to happen, and you're willing to kind of fail fast. So there are various stages through the process, and we make it a relatively quick process. We don't want it to last more than about 8 weeks. And by 8 weeks, you're sort of done, but you might be done sooner, because you may not make it to the eighth week. And this willingness to fail fast enables you to learn and use that learning in terms of the next use case you may pursue with a customer. part of what's happening with external customers is they're interested in what technology we think makes sense. But more and more what's happening is they're telling us, we want you to interface to this technology. Like, we've decided this is the DLT we want to implement, or this is the blockchain we want to implement. So we'd like you to create an interface to that. So now we have to actually broaden our horizons quite a bit beyond simply the Hyperledger fabric. So that's what companies are going to, in some cases, struggle with, in some cases, capitalize on. So the more you know about the broader array of technologies available, the more you'll be able to interface to your clients. And that'll be a demand on the client side. And again, right now it's probably more experimentation than anything else. But if you're unwilling to experiment with your customers, you'll be left behind probably at some point in time. Also, educating the regulators has become pretty important. There's so much out there, you know, in the press. It's more about the experiences we're having than is this safe or unsafe. There's so much hoopla, you know, about what's going on that you don't have to explain why you're doing it. You just have to explain what you're learning. So that's good. And there's a lot of openness these days with regulators because in many ways this is a technology that's going to solve a real problem for the industry, right? Forgetting about the disruptive nature of it, it solves an integrity issue that companies struggle with. Anytime you have to do reconciliations, it implies either automated or manual processes that could go wrong. And of course, regulators are interested in solving that problem. So these are the companies and consortiums and technologies we originally were experimenting with. And this is kind of how we viewed the space back then, in kind of early 2016. And I'd been with the company for probably about a month at that point. And again, we tended to focus more on Hyperledger Fabric than anything else because we could learn faster. We could kind of learn on our own. There was a lot more information available. Again, we had a good working relationship with IBM, which helped us quite a bit. There were a number of companies that were knocking on my door, frankly, asking for handouts. and there were a lot of companies like ours and others that wanted to invest in a lot of companies. And frankly, the stance we took was, we're not a venture capital company. We're not a private equity company. We don't make investments in companies. We invest our time. And that includes on the business side as well as on the technology side to try to determine where is the best place to evaluate this technology. And you could get very distracted very fast, and it could, you know, cost you a fair amount of money if you decide, you know, you're going to invest in a number of different areas. So we didn't do that, which was kind of hard because it reminded me of 1999 when everybody was very, very convinced that, you know, the internet and all these different investments in companies was going to disrupt all these different industries. And you didn't have to have actually a business case. All you needed to believe was that, you know, you were going to be investing in eyeballs, monitoring your website, and that was good enough. It didn't have to be a financial business case. There was a little bit of that happening here, where people were spending a fair amount of money in a lot of different investments. We didn't do that. Again, we concentrated on trying to make it work in a few cases. So for us, again, Hyperledger kind of ticked the boxes that we felt were important. We saw good redundancy and resiliency. That's obviously very, very critical for us. A private network that met enterprise standards, data segregation, and a flexible consensus model. That was important. And then, you know, successful, well-branded, well-capitalized companies, Intel, IBM, and the Linux Foundation that were really in support of the Hyperledger fabric. That was initially, again, back in the late 2015, early 2016 timeframe. And we see things kind of moving in a direction where there's investments taking place. These companies aren't standing still. So they're getting better at what was an original implementation. For example, Corda is implementing in what I call enterprise instrumentation of the technology that makes it scalable, there's a bit of self-healing going on there, and you feel like it's going to be highly scalable and highly reliable. That really matters, of course, in our industry. Because although these technologies are very interesting in terms of the problems they can solve, more often than not, they're not as resilient as advertised or what you may need. The more you have a dependency on this type of technology, the more the resiliency really matters. I remember making a decision. I also worked at IBM in the old days, and I was a systems programmer for mainframe computers. So I was modifying the operating system on big mainframe computers. That stuff really had to work. And when I moved, it was Morgan Stanley, into the distributed computing world, it was completely different. So we moved from managing 6 computers to 10,000 computers, completely different problem. So when you have a problem like that, reliability and scalability still matters, but it's a much more complex thing to manage. So what we had to do was figure out a way to be able to manage multiple vendors in a very, very large scale environment that was as reliable as the mainframe computers, which was extremely difficult to do. We ended up having to build a lot of proprietary software on top of what was open systems, you know, Unix-based systems, in order to make it reliable. You knew things were going to break. You didn't know when, so you had to try to anticipate, and when it did happen, you had to make sure it didn't actually impact your environment. More and more, that's what we're going to need to see with these DLT implementations. So it's not just about the throughput, it's about the reliability of the underlying infrastructure. So the way we're looking at the options now is, for us, it's about supporting what we believe is a decentralized consortium. So the industry we operate in, it consists of members that trade together, members that are dependent on each other, and are involved collectively in reconciliation. This, again, eliminates that. But you have to have an extremely high degree of confidence that, in fact, it's working as designed. So although people talk about how DLT creates disruption, somebody has to guarantee that the transaction is valid and has high integrity. So in many ways, you know, you're sort of putting your reputation on the line, your financials on the line, if you will. And in order to do that, you've got to make sure that the technology really works well for you. And again, it's about reliability, scalability, proper instrumentation, and so on. So just because it's a distributed ledger, that doesn't mean it's going to be fault tolerant, for example. So the added value that we bring to the table is making sure that the platform that we have is highly, highly available, as you would find in a fault tolerant infrastructure. I've experienced doing that in building market data systems on fault-tolerant platforms for hardware and software, which at the time I did this was very proprietary. So what will happen here, I believe, is you'll have, even for the open source implementations, there'll be several different variants that have proprietary technology in it, A, to add scalability and to add reliability, in addition to adding features and the ability to modify and add services to that technology. So where we're kind of moving to now, and where we think the use cases are, is there's, of course, the efficiency. Right. Again, this is eliminating the any kind of reconciliation. Obviously, settlement becomes like a T plus zero. Right. Much more efficient and direct regulatory reporting, and obviously the IT costs are reduced over time, as well as any of your operational middle office and back office costs tend to get highly compressed. And again, provided the reliability is there, your IT operations costs will go down as well. The issue with this is you're putting a lot of eggs in one basket, again, that you really have to rely on the scalability and reliability of the underlying technology. We believe that digitizing assets, smart contracts, that's where there's going to be a lot of applicability as well. So the opportunities are pretty significant for a number of different players. Obviously, you're seeing a lot about the opportunity in cryptocurrencies and tokenization. Those concepts and the underlying technologies there are regulated very differently by country. The U.S. has a way of thinking about securities versus tokens that are different than probably the way we think about it here. We witnessed an interesting presentation as part of a technology advisory committee of the board at LSEG on how the regulators in the U.S. are handling cryptocurrencies and tokens, for example. So there's a set of opportunities there. There's a set of opportunities in building applications on a blockchain, digital assets. We've been doing some work with digital assets. Beginning to use their software development toolkit right now, their SDK. And what they've done, their added value is they've got the traditional, if you will, blockchain, and on top of the blockchain, a language they call DAML. And DAML is an easy way of interfacing to the blockchain at a different level. So you're able to build services on top of the blockchain that you can sell to your customers. And I believe that's their competitive advantage, the fact that they're going to provide DAML. They may do open source it, I'm not sure, but they're going to provide that toolkit so that you can easily build services on top of the blockchain that they've adopted. And that's something that's relatively unique, I think, in the industry. Others will not provide that. You'll have to build your own type interface language and build your own services using some interface language. So here are some of the opportunities that we're thinking about. So the digitization of bonds and equities for smaller mid-market companies. There are new secondary markets beyond the traditional exchange for smaller issuers. Certainly, lower cost of capital raising because you've really compressed the cost structure because you've eliminated a lot of what was very expensive reconciliation. You see this more and more in the commodity space, the digitizing of commodities on a blockchain. Right? That's very, very broad around the world. The way that CSDs and custodians operate will change, again, significantly. The work that they do is going to be very different than the work that they do today. So that's going to change the market infrastructure. It doesn't necessarily change the regulatory environment. It just changes what people do to abide by the regulatory environment. I talked about T+0 settlement time. Over time, because less systems will be involved in a settlement process, where you're really able to reduce the complexity within an ecosystem of participants in a market structure. So we've decided to collaborate in the context of consortiums as opposed to create labs and invest directly in companies. We feel that it enables us to learn more faster. And again, since we're not in the business of trying to figure out if we're going to get liquidity out of these investments we're making in blockchain companies, it's not the model that we've adapted. So we continue to focus on being members of a couple of different consortiums so that we can learn and also contribute in many ways. And the Hyperledger PTDL, which we were one of the founding members of that, we've actively involved our customers. We're learning what customers are also adopting in terms of the blockchains that they're interested in. And again, I believe that we'll end up having a core solution within the firm. We'll offer a core solution to our members as part of our business model, but we're also going to have to develop expertise in possibly a number of different solutions just to retain some of the customers that we have because of the business mix that we have. We have clearing houses, we have the information businesses, which are indexes and analytics, and then we have the exchanges. And so that's a fairly broad client mix across a variety of different products that we have to contend with in terms of what our clients want to do. So here's what we've learned so far. The best opportunity is for small, medium-sized capital raising and bond issuance, creating secondary markets and standards for valuation from the smaller companies, and digital representation of commodities. The replacing of infrastructure over time is going to take a long time. Part of it is replacing any legacy infrastructure is hard, much less with something that's, you know, fairly new technology, because you have to believe it's ready and that people are comfortable with it. So we're going to want to use it for new things, necessarily so, and again, or reconciliation, as opposed to replacing big systems and saving money that way. That's just too hard. It's too long a road. We don't believe we should make a bet on a single dominant player. So that's the hard part. It's sort of like, in many ways, when you were making a decision to adopt a Unix implementation back in the 80s and 90s, picking one was probably dangerous at the time. So I remember picking three and demanding that my developers wrote code that would work on all three platforms. At the time, it was a Sun platform, an IBM platform, and a Hewlett-Packard platform, and their code had to run on all three, or we didn't put it in production. Ironically, with all due respect to IBM, none of those solutions were the end game. It became an open source solution called Linux, as we all know today. And I remember in 1989 making a decision on these different three implementations like we might today with blockchain. And then 10 years later, I moved Merrill Lynch from various implementations to actually Linux. And that was a big, in fact, in doing that, IBM was making a significant investment in Linux at the time, which was sort of ironic. So you have to have enough expertise to feel like you can put this stuff in production and maintain it at reasonable scale, and try to insulate yourself against any one big bet. So that requires investment, and it requires building some software that possibly insulates you against, again, any one single implementation. You really don't want to put all your eggs in one basket at this stage. It's too costly. So what do we want to learn more? We really want to get a handle on scalability and performance. We don't really have yet implemented any use cases that really have driven the technologies to a point where we're comfortable with it yet. Because we're doing it with new things that are relatively low volume at this stage. The productivity, the benefits we will get as a business really are derived from the services we'll offer on the blockchain. In order to do that, we've got to really get up to snuff quickly on how we build services on the various blockchains. And again, some are easier to work with and some are harder. The DAH one is good if you understand their language, their DAML language, and we're learning that now. And that could be very productive, for example. Settle has something similar. It's kind of a script-type language where you can interface to their underlying blockchain, which happens to be Corda. And Corda, again, is a high-performing infrastructure as well. Probably the Settle script language isn't as sophisticated as the DAML. So the impact that you're going to have as a business is directly related to the technologist's ease of use of creating services on the blockchain. So becoming familiar how to do that is a big investment. It's like, again, what companies did when they shifted from, you know, mainframe or mini computing to a Unix environment. Think of all the programmers that had to be hired and trained initially to do C and C++, and then ultimately, you know, Java became more of a standard because it was insulated from the platform, generally speaking. So we're having to make a whole new series of investments. It's good if you're a technologist and like to learn, but it's a series of investments that you really have to make. So the way to think about us now is we're less focused on the one Hyperledger Fabric implementation, and we're more, I would say, I use the words open-minded, because A, we have more time, and B, we really have to start expanding our dialogue. And right now we're expanding that with R3 Corda as well as DAH in particular, because we see demand coming from customers, and we see some tools that are being built that are tools that we really want to learn to become more productive at creating services. So we're shifting from will it work to how do we become more productive at interfacing to it. So that's kind of where we are today. And that's all I have for tonight.